Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Yeah, I have to start by correcting myself about something that I said towards the end of the last class. That is when we came to the end of the discussion of the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. If you remember, the very last sentence, or if you look back at the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the sutta ends by saying that those bhikkhus did not delight in the Blessed One's words. And then I said that, in my opinion, that this was probably somehow a typographical error or a recitation error going back to an early period which got somehow preserved in the Pali tradition. And then I said that I looked into the three Chinese translations, or three different Chinese versions, and that they all said that the monks delighted in the Blessed One's words, so that they differed from the Pali version. But actually, what I did with respect to one of the Chinese versions was just to look at the last line without actually reading the sutta. And the last line says that the monks delighted in the Blessed One's words. But then I actually read the sutta, and the sutta says, towards the end, after the Buddha speaks the sutta, it said, this is what the Buddha said, and the monks did not accept the Buddha's words because Mara had closed up their minds. But then it goes on to say that the Buddha realized this and then told the monks, this teaching called the root of all things is very important. You should accept it. You should retain it in mind. You should reflect on it. You should meditate upon it while sitting under the root, at the foot of trees. Since this teaching is emphasized by all the Buddhas. And then when the Buddha said that, then the text says that the monks accepted the Buddha's words and delighted in his teachings. So I just looked at the last line and thought that it meant that it indicated that the monks delighted in the Blessed One's words. But the fact that this version of the sutta, this Chinese version, and the Pali version show that the monks resisted accepting the Buddha's words indicates that there's an ancient source for this idea that in some way the monks who originally heard the Mula Pariyaya Sutta didn't accept it. So there's a basis for this Pali a statement that the monks did not delight in the Blessed One's words. It's not just the reciter's mistake that was preserved. Okay, today we come to the Kitagiri Sutta. This is Sutta number 70. In the Majjhima Nikaya. And this sutta has a special importance in that it will take us into a particular way of classifying or categorizing the types of disciples who reach stages of attainment, stages of realization of the noble, the supramundane paths and fruits. And this is a somewhat different scheme from that with which we are usually acquainted. The usual way of dividing the classes of noble disciples that we've come across previously is according to the four stages of noble attainment. The stage of stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and arahant. And then those are sometimes subdivided into eight stages according to the four types who are on the path to realization of the fruit, and then the four who have attained the fruit. But this sutta will give us a different system of classifying the disciples who have reached attainment. Okay, the sutta takes place at a town called Kitagiri, which is in Kasi country. Kasi country would be in the part of India which is now called Uttar Pradesh, somewhere in the area of Benares. And it starts off when the Buddha gives the injunction to the monks to abstain from eating at night. And the Buddha says that he abstains from eating at night. And so he requests the monks, he says that by doing so, I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding, living in good health. And so now he asks the monks to abstain from eating at night. And he says, by doing so, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. And then the monks agree to do so. Okay, then on one occasion, the Buddha was wandering by stages in the Kasi country, this area in what's now Uttar Pradesh, and eventually he arrived at the Kasi town called Kitagiri, and he lived in the town of Kitagiri. Okay, now on that occasion, there were two bhikkhus named Asaji and Puna Basuka who were residing at Kitagiri. They were living there, but they were the heads of a community of monks who were under their guidance, who were also staying with them. And a number of monks went and told them about this injunction that the Buddha had given to the Sangha to abstain from eating at night, and requested them to observe this new regulation. But when these monks, Asaji and Puna Basuka, got these instructions from those visiting monks, they refused to accept the advice. They said that now we eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the afternoon as well. That's in the day, beyond the normal time for the meal. And they say, by doing so, we are free from illness and affliction, and we enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. So they say, why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit that can come at a future time? And so they determined to pursue their own practice, eating in the evening, in the morning, and later in the day, late in the afternoon. Okay, so these monks were unable to convince the monks Asaji and Puna Basuka to change their ways. And so they went to the Buddha and reported to them what the Buddha had said. The Buddha goes to them, or the Buddha sends another monk as a messenger and asks these monks to come to him. And so these monks come to the Buddha, and then the Buddha, then when the two monks, Asaji and Punabhasuka, come to the Buddha then first he questions them about the way they've replied to those monks, and then the Buddha goes into a kind of questionnaire with them on the nature of feelings. It's a little bit obscure, the point of the Buddha's questionnaire, but the basic point that he's driving at, I won't go through all of the questions and all of the answers, but the basic point seems to be that the Buddha has determined that there are certain types of pleasant feelings that are connected with wholesome states of mind and with unwholesome states of mind. And that he understands that though pleasant feelings might arise, but when these pleasant feelings arise, they're also accompanied by unwholesome states of mind. And so when the Buddha lays down regulations, the purpose of these regulations are to cut down the arising of the unwholesome states of mind. And what seems to be the subtext underlying this is that the Buddha has laid down this regulation regarding food because he wants to cut down the unwholesome states of greed, attachment, and concern that could arise over food by restricting the time period in which the monks can take the food. In the early period of the Buddhist monastic order, there were no regulations concerning the time of food, and monks were able to take food at any time. But the Buddha's own practice, even from the very early period, was just to take one meal a day in the forenoon. And the Buddha would sometimes give instructions or encouragement to the monks to follow his own practice. And those monks who wanted to emulate the Buddha would also just take one meal a day in the forenoon. But other monks were free to take their meals at any time during the day. And sometimes they would go on alms round in the afternoon, in the evening. And then on one occasion, on a dark night in stormy weather, a monk was going on alms round in the evening. And a woman had come out to wash dishes or to throw out some food to be discarded. And the monk was standing outside her house with his alms bowl waiting to collect food. And just then there was a flash of lightning. And she saw that monk there and she thought it was a ghost or a goblin who had come. Because people were superstitious in that period and they believed in ghosts and goblins. And suddenly when she comes out, there's a flash of lightning and there's a strange figure there with shaved head, with a robe standing there. And she's terrified and she screams out, "Good grief, a goblin has come for me." And then the monk says, "I'm not a goblin, I'm a monk." And then she says, "A monk, what are you doing standing here?" And he says, "I've come to collect alms food." And then she says, "Don't you have a mother? Don't you have a father that you have to come on a stormy night like this to collect alms food?" And then she complained about it, and then the complaint eventually reached the Buddha. And for this reason, the Buddha lay down this regulation prohibiting the taking of food at night. This comes also in the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. This is the Vinaya preserved in Chinese translation. It's the same story. It's mentioned in Sutta number 66 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And so though there was this practical reason for the Buddha to lay down this regulation, and I think not only because occasionally a monk might go on alms rounds at night and frighten a woman, but also when large numbers of monks would be going on alms rounds at different periods of the day, this would create a burden for lay people since they would be expecting monks to come at different periods of the day, and so they would have to prepare food at different times of the day, not knowing, are monks going to come today at midday? Are they going to come in the evening? Are they going to come in the morning? But if there's a fixed time that monks will always come on alms round in the morning, then people will prepare the food only in the morning. And so in this way, it makes it much easier for lay people to prepare the food for the monks in a fixed period of time. And also, according to this questionnaire on feelings, the point of this seems to be that because for monks in training, one has to control the greed and attachment that arise centered around food, unwholesome states of mind. And so if one is eating many times during the day, then there's a tendency for that greed and attachment to arise several times during the day. Whereas if one is eating only in the forenoon, then one has a chance to control the mind and keep the mind, to restrain the desire and attachment that arise based on food, and keep it focused only within a bit limited period of time. Okay, so now with paragraph 11, we come to the important part of the sutta, the part that deals, this is where the Buddha introduces the different classes. He's going to introduce the different classes of noble disciples. And so now he says, I do not say of all monks that they still have work to do with diligence, nor do I say of all monks that they have no more work to do with diligence. I think this idea of having work to do with diligence is connected with the idea in the previous paragraphs of the wholesome and unwholesome states of mind that arise. So if there's a tendency for unwholesome states of mind to arise, especially connected with pleasant feelings, then one has work to do with diligence. And so now the Buddha is going to show who has work to do with diligence and who has no more work to do with diligence. And so in paragraph 12, the Buddha says that, I do not say of those monks who are arahants, then we have the standard description of the arahants, they are those who have destroyed the taints or the asavas. These are the three asavas, or three flowing defilements. What are the three asavas?
Desire for existence,
Right. It's the craving for sensual pleasures, craving for continued existence, and ignorance. Okay, they have lived the holy life, the spiritual life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal. They've destroyed the fetters of existence. That means they've cut off all of the 10 fetters, and they are completely liberated through final knowledge. So the Buddha says of the Arhants that they have, that they do not have any more work to do with diligence, so with heedfulness. And why is that? They have done their work with diligence, and they are no more capable of being negligent. Okay, so for this reason, the Arahants are called by another term in Pali. The term is asaka, which means, literally it means, those who do not have any more training. But not in the sense that they've dropped the training, but rather in the sense that they've finished the training. Okay, and the arhats who are beyond training or finished with training, they're contrasted with the monks who are being described in paragraph 13. Here it's called the bhikkhus who are in higher training. These are called seka. You could also call these trainees. And here comes the standard description, whose minds have not yet reached the goal, and who are still aspiring for the supreme security from bondage. And it's said of them, they still have work to do with diligence. And why is that? Because when these venerable ones make use of suitable resting places or dwelling places, lodgings, that is, lodgings, dwelling places that are conducive to meditation practice or other types of spiritual development, and when they associate with good friends, spiritual friends, and when they balance their spiritual faculties. Here we have the five spiritual faculties. What are the five spiritual faculties? Faith. Did you say concentration? Right, yeah. And wisdom, right. Okay, so the five spiritual faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, so suitable dwelling place, help from good friends, these are sort of external conditions. Then the internal condition is balancing the spiritual faculties. And now the question, in balancing the spiritual faculties, which faculties have to be balanced against which? Usually.
Energy and equanimity?
You still want to put equanimity amongst the spiritual faculties. Well, usually... Yeah, usually they're balanced. And faith and wisdom, right. And mindfulness, what does that get balanced with? Yeah. Yeah, mindfulness is sort of what oversees the balancing. Mindfulness is the balancing agent, so it doesn't have to be balanced against anything. Okay, so by balancing the spiritual faculties, then they may, by realization for themselves with direct knowledge, here and now enter and dwell in that supreme goal of the spiritual life, for the sake of which clansmen and, say, clanswomen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. So seeing this fruit of diligence or effort for these bhikkhus, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. Okay, so now the Buddha has made this general distinction between the arahants, those who have completed the training, and those who are still in training. And now in paragraph 14, he introduces this classification of disciples. He says that there are seven kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What are the seven? Okay, the seven, first he gives the concise statement. They are: one, liberated in both ways, one liberated by wisdom, the body witness, one attained to view, one liberated by faith, a Dhamma follower and a faith follower. Okay, in the set of seven, first we have a contrast between two types of arahants. The two arahants are the one liberated in both ways and one liberated by wisdom. I will put the Pali names for these on the board. Yeah, the two, they're also mentioned in Chinese texts. The liberated by, Panya Vimutta, liberated by wisdom, is Chu Wei Jie To, I think. Wei Jie To. And the liberated in both ways? Jiu Jie To. Jiu Jie To, right. Okay, now here we have the definition of the one who's liberated in both ways. And then I'll explain why he's called liberated in both ways. Okay, here some person contacts with the body. It's an interesting statement. I didn't have time to pick up the Pali book from the library, but I almost know this definition by memory in Pali. Kayena pusit va. It's, the word is the same as the word for the physical body. He contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial or formless, transcending forms, and his taints or asavas, the influxes, are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom, this kind of person is called one liberated in both ways. Okay, now, if you remember when we were going through the different stages of meditative attainments, not experientially, but when we were explaining them, we saw that there are four jhanas, first, second, third, fourth jhana. Then beyond the fourth jhana, there are four other stages called four formless attainments. And then there's a stage called the cessation of perception and feeling, sanyavedayita nirodha. Okay, now it's said that a person who is liberated in both ways is one who is able to, uses this very physical terminology, he's able to contact with the body and dwell in those liberations that are peaceful and formless, transcending forms. And his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. So he's liberated in one way, he's liberated through wisdom from all defilements. And by being liberated through the destruction of all defilements, he's liberated from birth and death, from samsara. Okay, so this type of disciple, through the power of wisdom, cuts off all of the defilements, the taints, the fetters, and so on. And so through liberation from the defilements, he's liberated from samsara, the round of birth and death. And also through the power of especially strong samadhi, this disciple is able to dwell beyond forms. He's liberated from the limitations of the material form realm while alive. And thus he's able to dwell in the formless meditations, in these formless or immaterial liberations. That is, he's able to go beyond the four jhanas and to dwell in these four formless meditative attainments, and some can go even up to the base, up to the cessation of perception and feeling. The suttas themselves don't make any clear distinction. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I should say that in the Mahanidana Sutta and the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha speaks about the most excellent of the disciples who are called both ways liberated. And he said, that is the one who is able to go up and down through all of these meditative attainments whenever he wants, for as long as he wants. whenever he wants, wherever he wants, for as long as he wants. That is sort of the highest capacity amongst those who are both ways liberated. But there are sort of different degrees of those who are both ways liberated. The minimum degree is a meditator who is able to achieve just the base of infinite space can still count as one who is both ways liberated. But some can go further and reach the base of infinite consciousness and then achieve arhatship based on that. Some go further, reach the base of nothingness and achieve arhatship. Some have the base of neither perception nor non-perception, as well as arhatship. But the Buddha says the most excellent is the one who has all nine attainments that are achieved through the power of samadhi, as well as the destruction of the taints. Okay, the other type of arhat, this is the one called liberated by wisdom, the Panyavimutta arhat. It said that this is a person who does not contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful. Everything else is the same, and does not abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated by wisdom. And then the Buddha says, I do not say of such a bhikkhu that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? He has done his work with diligence, and he is no more capable of being negligent. So even though this monk doesn't achieve the formless meditations, the Buddha doesn't urge him to go on to attain them, because he's reached the final goal, and what he's achieved is sufficient, even though he doesn't have the formless meditations. And now the question comes up, what degree of samadhi is necessary to become liberated by wisdom? And it's sometimes thought that to become liberated by wisdom means that one doesn't have any jhana. But in fact, all that is said in the suttas is that the one who's liberated by wisdom doesn't have the formless meditations, or doesn't dwell contacting with the body, the formless liberations. So one who is liberated by wisdom could still be attainer of the fourth jhana, the third jhana, the second jhana, or the first jhana. And now, the suttas themselves do not mention the possibility of achieving, do not explicitly mention the possibility of achieving arhatship without the attainment of jhana. But in the commentaries, we say the commentarial literature, both in the Theravada school and also in the Abhidharma literature of the northern school, or say the Abhidharma Kosha, or say the Abhidharma literature of the Sarvastivada school, we find recognition of the possibility of achieving arhatship without possession even of the first jhana. in the Theravada school, in the commentaries, mention of made is made of a type of arhant who comes to be called the Sudha Vipassaka Arhat. The Sukha Vipassaka Arhat, which means the dry insight Arhat. Yeah, the word Sukha, not to be confused with the word Sukha meaning happiness. This is the word Sukha meaning dry, because jhana is conceived of as a kind of moisture which moistens the mind and makes the mind soft and pliable. And so when there's no jhana, then the insight is considered to be dry. And the word vipassaka is based on vipassana, insight. So a practitioner of insight is called vipassaka, one who does insight. So one who practices this dry insight is called the Sukha Vipassaka, the practitioner of dry insight. So in the commentaries, like Visuddhimagga and other commentaries, this type of meditator is recognized, and it's recognized that such a meditator can even achieve arhatship, and this becomes a type of Panyavimutta Arhat, one who is liberated by the power of wisdom. And then I found in some of the literature of the Savastivada Abhidharma, they speak about the possibility of reaching arhatship. They don't have an expression that corresponds to Sukha Vipassaka, but they speak about the possibility of developing Samatha or serenity meditation, not to the level of jhana, but to a level below the jhana, and then on that basis developing insight to the degree necessary to reach arhatship. And so one becomes an arhant without the full development of jhana. And so this possibility is recognized in both of these commentarial traditions. And these are types of Panyavimutta arhat. Okay, and so even though the wisdom-liberated arhat, Panyavimutta arhat, doesn't have this type of liberation, the liberation from the form realm. He's not able to enter and dwell in the formless attainments, but he still has the wisdom that has eradicated the defilements, and by eradicating the defilements he has gained liberation from the round of birth and death, from samsara. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask if there's any questions, anything needs clarification.
In paragraph 13, I wonder if you could say another sentence or two of explanation as to why these trainees still need to make further effort. You read the sentence about associating with good friends and making use of suitable lodging, but it wasn't quite clear to me why they still need to make further effort on the basis of that.
Yeah, they need to make further effort precisely because they're still in training, because they haven't reached the final goal of the spiritual life. And so they have to develop their faculties further. They have to develop further their mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Energy, concentration, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Those faculties have to be developed further.
It's not because they're in some ways enjoying that life inappropriately. That's the sense I got from that sentence, but I think I'm misreading it.
No, that would be misreading it. Because they are trainees, because the Buddha says that they are sakas, they're in higher training, and they're aspiring for the supreme security from bondage. So, but they do, one would have to say that they are capable of being negligent. They do have that possibility. So the Buddha does urge them to make further effort. But it's not that he sees that they are actually being negligent. Yes, Eva?
For the meditative attainment, the fifth one, formless cessation of possession and fear. Is that true only our hand able to reach that one? The person cannot reach the fifth attainment?
Actually, the fifth one, the cessation of perception and feeling, the way it's explained in the Theravada commentarial tradition, with support from the suttas, can be attained by anagamis also, by non-returners. But it said only by non-returners and arhats who already have, they have to have achieved the other eight attainments. Because in order to go into the fifth attainment, into the cessation of perception and feeling, they have to base themselves on, they have to use as the basis, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And then they contemplate all of these earlier attainments. They contemplate them as impermanent, dukkha, and non-self. And then they rise from each one. They go on to the next higher one, contemplating it with insight as impermanent, dukkha, and non-self. Then they go up to the base of nothingness. After they've already mastered the fourth one, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, but in order to go into the base, into the state of cessation of perception and feeling, they go into the base of nothingness, dwell in it for some time, come out of it, they contemplate it as impermanent, suffering, non-self. Then they make a determination to go into the cessation of perception and feeling. Then they have to make some other preliminary determinations with the mind. Then, when they direct their mind to going into it, if I remember correctly, they'll go into the base of neither perception nor non-perception just for a few moments, and then the process of perception and feeling will come to an end. And then they're in the base of, in the cessation of perception and feeling.
I had thought that the path of samadhi was a means for liberation. I thought established the conditions for insight and wisdom, but not liberation itself. There were the Buddha's first two teachers, he attained.
Yeah.
His jhanic states,
yeah.
Not liberation.
Yeah.
But here it suggests that samadhi is a path to liberation rather than setting the conditions.
The samadhi itself can't bring the liberation, but the samadhi has to go along with wisdom. It's wisdom which brings the insight that eliminates the asavas, the defilements. That's why for the one who's liberated in both ways, it's said that for this one too, his taints or defilements are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. So the stages of samadhi are not what brings the liberation from the defilements and liberation from samsara. The stages of samadhi bring the other kind of liberation, which is the liberation from the form realm into the formless realm. But also that samadhi can be a basis, that calm and the concentration of mind that comes through the samadhi will be a basis for developing the insight too. Yes.
I'm just a little bit confused on that same point. It seems that you do need some level of wisdom to obtain further and further stages along these nine levels here, right? I mean, you do need to understand dukkha anicca anatta.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's a good question. Ordinarily, to go through the jhanas and the formless attainments, one doesn't need that insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta. That is, if one is a meditator just for the jhanas and formless attainments, one doesn't need that insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta. But this is the special case for going into the cessation of perception and feeling, because that is open only for anagamis, non-returners, and arhants. And so the anagamis and arhants already have the wisdom of insight. And so now they're using that wisdom of insight as the means for going into that cessation. And so they're doing this. This is like the special method for going into the cessation of perception and feeling. To go up the ladder of the samadhi attainments, not in the ordinary way, just by going up as exercises of concentration, but one has to back up each one with the insight into its impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self nature. Then, when one gets to the stage of base of nothingness, then one has to do some preparations, like make some special determinations, the amount of time that one is going to stay in it. It's described, the method in Visuddhimagga, path of purification. I think it's chapter 22, 23. It describes the process.
Okay, how did the Sukha, Dukkha, Sukha, Arahat concept arrive in the commentarial literature without a sutta support?
Okay, how did the Sukha Vipassaka concept arise in the commentaries without a sutta support? What I said is that there's not an explicit sutta basis for it, but there are some suttas which seem to be suggesting the idea of different pathways that meditators can take. Some have a smooth, easier path, which is said that they go smoothly through first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Then it speaks about another type of meditator. It doesn't say that they don't have jhanic attainments, but it says that they do the meditations like the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, the meditation on death, the meditation on the impermanence of all formations, the meditation on the unsatisfactory nature of all the world. So those types of meditations seem to be suggesting a path that's almost like a dry insight path, though it's not explicitly said that this is a path without insight, without jhana. And then I think at some point the Satipatthana Sutta came to be interpreted as a path or a method without insight, without jhana. Because it said that the Satipatthana Sutta says that those who practice in this way, you know, from 7 years down to 7 months to 7 days, will achieve one of two results, either final knowledge here and now, or if there's some delay, the stage of non-returner. And yet the Satipatthana Sutta, though some of its methods can be used for jhana, but it doesn't especially emphasize jhanic attainment. And so my supposition is that there were like early schools of meditators that were based on the Satipatthana Sutta, that within those schools, the concept of the dry insight practitioner could have gained currency. But this is speculation, because I don't know. You know, we lack the very early commentaries, the pre-Buddhaghosa commentaries, so we can't really trace the stages through which the concept evolved. But one point is quite interesting, that I found that there's one sutta that exists in the Pali version. It's called the I just did a paper on it. Susima Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, Susima Sutta. It has a counterpart in two, three counterparts in Chinese agamas. In the Chinese Da'ahang Jing, the Chinese Samyutta Agama version, there's a group of monks who had claimed to be arhants. In the Pali version, it's said that they don't have the supernormal powers and they don't have the formless attainments. And they're declared, in the Pali version, they declare that we are panyavimutta, we are liberated by wisdom. In the version preserved in Chinese translation, they claim to be panyavimutta. Panyavimutta. Vajjator. But it's said that what they deny having is the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. How is that possible? They say we are liberated by wisdom. And then that sutta, it's commented on by a commentary. This is the Mahavibhasha commentary, which explains that the Panyavimutta arhat is one who doesn't necessarily have any jhana. They have what? They have something, it's called the neighborhood concentration. It's a concentration which is approximating to the jhana, but it doesn't amount to the jhana. It's called In the Pali system, it would be called upachara samadhi, access concentration. I think in Sanskrit it's samantara, coming close. It's called coming close concentration. Samantara dhyana, coming close to jhana. Do you remember the Chinese name for that? Jin fan jin ding. Any further questions? Okay, then we will wrap up for this evening. There was a little supplement that was to be sent out. Did everybody get the little supplement that I'll take also next week? Did you get the little supplement? It's from Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 25. It's just two pages, I think. Then bring that next week. I'll take that for discussion next week, too. It ties in with the rest of this sutta. Okay, so we will conclude by sharing with the merits. Share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, the nagas, and all the other beings. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punyasampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punyasampadang. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.